Okay, good morning. This is about 2:41, our second meeting, and it is January 21st. Okay, and so I have one announcement. Today's class is canceled because of bad weather. Just kidding. Kidding. I wouldn't do that to you. After making it through, you probably rode your paddle boards into work today, or to school, so I wouldn't do that to you. So we're going to carry on with lecture, but I do have an announcement. There are some students that were lucky enough to find a space in lab to add the class, and that's how you get into this class, right? You have to find a spot in lab. So if there's still people wanting to add the class, I can't give you add codes. You have to get it from your lab instructor, or he will forward your name to me, and I'll give you an add code. All right. The other thing that I want to say is that the prerequisite for this class is either 210, which is an A&P class, or anatomy, which is 231. So even if you got an add code from your lab instructor, you still have to have those prerequisites. If you don't have those prerequisites, unfortunately, you're going to get dropped by the computer eventually. All right, so if you got an add code, make sure you show me your transcripts. Okay, I need to see your transcript. So raise your hand if you got an add code. Raise your hand. Yeah, you got to show me your transcripts, that you have the prerequisites for the class. All right. I'm not going to make you take the chemistry class, but you got to have at least 231 or 210 on this campus, right, in order to take this class. Okay. Yeah, so if you need add codes, I don't know if you got add codes already. If you did get add codes, then the only thing you have to show me are your transcripts, okay? And most of those, of course, it could be unofficial. Those you can pull off the web most places, very easy, okay? All right, so what's real important, make sure this week that you are registered for the class and that you are showing up in Blackboard. That's your confirmation that you're registered properly. And make sure you can get into Blackboard and download the exam study guide, what other materials I have there for you, and start working on that this weekend. So your goal this week is to make sure you can get into Blackboard, make sure your password is proper. If you can't, then you have to see me during office hours. All right, so I have office hours right after class. Even if you're in lab, you're going to have to excuse yourself from lab after you sign in, because if you don't go to lab today, you're going to be dropped. Sometime during lab, come down and see me in my office, and we'll work to make sure that that your username is correct and your password, and you can get into Blackboard, all right, and start working with those materials there. Okay, that's it's not mandatory, but it's so helpful that you should do it. Here's the sign-in sheet. So go ahead, start passing that around, and over here we have some more information regarding SI from Brianna. All right, we got a room number. Fantastic. 335. I guess I'll just read this out loud so it's on the tape. All right, it's Tuesdays and Thursdays, 1:20 to 3:20. So that gives you a little bit of a break after lecture, but it's almost right after lecture in Humanities, 335. Is that right? Yeah. Ooh, that's a pretty fancy building, I've been told. That's nice. Not as nice as over here, but anyway. Okay, so I have a little bit of a slide right here. We were talking about homeostasis and feedback loops. And so here is a response loop, which includes feedback. All right, so you should be able to, this is an exam figure, and I gave you a hard copy that you can fill in, but you should draw this from memory, from a blank piece of paper. How many steps, what the names of the steps are, what happens with these steps, where the feedback loop is completed right here, and then you should know a couple different kinds of feedback. All right, so we'll give you a real quick quiz. What does a response loop always end with? A response. What does it always start with? Stimulus. A stimulus, all right? And if it's negative feedback, what's the relationship between the response and the stimulus? Okay, what did I ask for? Positive or negative? Negative. What's the response? What is the relationship between response and stimulus if there's negative feedback? Okay. I heard antagonistic. That's pretty good, but we're going to work on that thought for a little bit. I kind of don't agree with that. We got two kinds of feedback. So let's say, what are the names of feedback? Positive and negative. All right. So not necessarily antagonistic, but positive and negative. So those are your two choices. Put your coins away. Don't flip a coin for this one. This you got to really know. If it's negative feedback, okay, how what's the relationship between the response and the stimulus?
It's like a thermostat. You have your set point.
Yeah.
When it gets too high,
yeah.
It automatically brings it back down. If it gets too low, it automatically brings it back up.
Okay, that's really good. But mathematically, I want you to be able to visualize what's going on there. That's a nice graphic. Okay, what are the two possibilities? Well, it's either positive feedback or negative feedback. And the relationship you should describe as either they subtract from each other or they add to each other. Okay, so that's what I'm thinking. So you have a more complete picture. I was kind of boiling it down to those two thoughts, right? But if it's positive feedback, what's the relationship between stimulus and response? They add together, and it drives it, what, farther and farther away from the set point, right? So that's how I want you to think about this. And this graphic right here, of course, is really handy for visualizing that. All right, let me start the program. We have one last slide to look at right here. Okay, so this is negative feedback hormonal control of blood glucose. Yeah. Okay, positive feedback. A question about positive feedback.
You have to have an external factor to stop it?
Some kind of external factor, I suppose, could stop it, like some kind of medical intervention. For instance, if somebody is hyperthermic and they're burning up inside, and so we jam some fluids in them right away, maybe pack them in ice right away, okay, and that would break the positive feedback cycle. Okay. Otherwise, temperature is going to increase, or some parameter is going to increase, and something's going to blow up. Okay, and usually when something inside you blows up, that's never a good thing. Okay, does that sort of answer your question? Like if your blood pressure goes high, and there's a positive feedback mechanism that makes it go higher, what's going to happen? A blood vessel is going to burst someplace, right? This is true. There are, for normal positive feedback cycles that happen not in a disease state, right, there's an internal intervention that takes place. Like for ovulation, the structure of the ovary drastically changes. An egg is expelled from the ovary, and the follicle is no longer a follicle. It becomes a corpus luteum. So it becomes a totally different kind of entity, and that breaks the positive feedback loop between luteinizing hormone and estrogen. All right, now some of these we're going to study when we get into endocrinology, so I'm not sure you're tracking with me exactly when I talk about LH and FSH. Depends on how much you learned in anatomy. And usually we don't go over hormones a whole lot in anatomy. Okay, so some of that you'll have to wait for the semester. Yeah?
I had the same question. It was confusing because it was trying to define in the lab that alpha intervention. So the other day when you talked about the insulin example, I totally thought that was positive feedback. Even though it brought it back because it was an external insulin.
It was a perturbation. It was just a kind of an insult to your body that would drive your blood glucose away from homeostasis. All right, so if we load you up with a lot of insulin, that drives your glucose metabolism far away from homeostasis. But if you're a normal, healthy individual, it's going to compensate and blood glucose is going to go back to normal. Now, if we put you on an IV drip of insulin, your blood glucose is never going to go back to normal, right?
I think it's confusing because we thought if there was an outside intervention, it absolutely had to be positive feedback. And that was described that way. That's
okay.
If it's bringing it back to homeostasis, if it's subtracting, it's negative, if it's adding.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly what I would like for you to see with that. Okay. All right, so now let's work on this concept of antagonism. It's going to take me just a little bit. Okay, which is an important word. As a matter of fact, that's probably the most important concept that you can develop or attain in this class, and that is a concept of antagonism. So if you have some family members or friends or whatever that are antagonistic to you, what kind of connotation does that bring along with it? Is it fun to be around people that are antagonistic to you? Is it a good thing or a bad thing in that sense? Well, it's a pain, right? It's usually a bad thing. But in terms of control systems, in terms of controlling your body, antagonism is the most important concept, I think, that you can appreciate in this class. And in anatomy, we start to talk about this even in terms of the musculoskeletal system. All right, so for instance, maybe tomorrow night, you go out to happy hour and on your way home, you get pulled over by the gentleman or gentlewoman with a fancy blue uniform and the badge and sidearm and the cap that's got a piece of plastic over it right now, right? And they saw you swerving around on the road, right? And they're interested to check your sobriety, and they tell you to take your fingertip and close your eyes and put it on the tip of your nose, okay? And you can do that if you have proper antagonistic control, not over the officer, right, but of your arm. And so you need two muscles, at least two muscles, to put your fingertip on the tip of your nose precisely, right? And what are these two muscles? All right, it's going to be the biceps brachii for flexion, but if you only have the biceps brachii, you're going to flex that muscle and you're going to poke your eye out or poke the officer in the eye or poke yourself in the nose, and, right, you're going to have a ride to the sheriff's office. Right, what else do you need besides that biceps brachii to control that finger? You need the triceps brachii, right? So these two muscles work in opposition to each other, but that's not a bad thing. That's a really, really nice thing. That's a great thing because when you have two control systems that work in opposition to each other, providing for antagonism, you have two things, balance and precise control. And that's what we would like to have in our bodies in terms of maintaining homeostasis, balance, right, and precise control. Another example would be in your automobile. You have two mechanisms that determine how far and fast your car goes, right, and you would never consider driving your car without these two antagonistic mechanisms. What are these two antagonistic mechanisms that I'm thinking about? And there might be others that you could think of. Like the gas and brake pedal, right? Without a brake pedal, you could certainly get home, right? You could step on the accelerator and get home, but once you got home, what would you have to do? Well, you just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop, right? So that's no fun. So antagonism is very important in terms of control systems, and we're going to learn how antagonism plays important roles, molecular level, in the nervous system, endocrine system, and you're already familiar, for instance, with the musculoskeletal system. All right, so here is a good example of antagonism that is two different antagonistic endocrine systems that work to control blood glucose levels. And do you think controlling blood glucose is an important topic? Okay, and does it cause any pathology in people when they can't regulate their blood glucose levels? Sure, I'm sure everybody knows somebody with, what condition is that called?
Diabetes
mellitus. There are different kinds of diabetes, but diabetes mellitus in particular. And that term diabetes actually means to siphon. Okay, and when somebody has diabetes, they're passing a lot of urine, they're in diuresis, and it's like siphoning fluid out of their body. And mellitus just means honey. So that's how they came up with that term, because when somebody has diabetes mellitus, they're actually passing a lot of glucose in their urine and it becomes very sweet, like honey. All right, so in the normal person, how does blood glucose get regulated? It's an important fuel molecule. We're going to see how important glucose is when we start talking about metabolism. All right, let me get my arrows working right here. Arrow options visible. Okay, so here we have a couple conditions. We got two conditions here. Somebody can be in an eating condition, all right? That means that you've had some kind of meal. And if you're not eating or have eaten recently, you're in a fasting state, right? So we have a fasted individual versus what we call sometimes a fed state. Fed state versus fasting. So if you want to put FED right here, that's good, right? Fed versus fasting. So when you're in a fed state, you've eaten a lot of sugars, for instance, like glucose. So what happens to your blood glucose levels? They go up because there's glucose in the food that you've eaten, and that gets absorbed from the digestive tract, ends up in the blood, that increases blood glucose. And that will drive you away from homeostasis. Even though glucose is an important molecule in your body, it drives you away from set point. Glucose should have a set point like other important parameters in your body. Well, there are sensors for that change, right? So an increase in blood glucose, how would you map that into your response loop? What component of that is the response loop? Increase in blood glucose. That is the, I heard somebody say, Stimulus. That's the stimulus. All right? And in order for your body to appreciate that stimulus, what does it need? Receptor. There are receptors in the pancreas, in particular the endocrine part of the pancreas. Remember, the pancreas has an exocrine part that synthesizes and secretes digestive enzymes, but it also has an endocrine part which can sense blood glucose. And when blood glucose increases, the islets of Langerhans, the cells in that area, secrete insulin. And insulin is a passport that allows glucose to be imported by cells. Cells cannot take up glucose by themselves, and we're going to see how that is later on in the class in the next couple of weeks. All right? It needs that signal, this insulin signal. And when there is insulin and high glucose in the blood, that glucose will go from blood into cells because insulin is a passport. And as insulin leaves the blood, guess what happens to blood glucose levels? It decreases. Okay? So here we see, and what do we call that decrease in blood glucose as a result of insulin secretion? That is the response. And what's the relationship between the response and the stimulus? Are these arrows in the same direction or opposite directions? Opposite directions. So mathematically, do they add or subtract from each other? They subtract. So what kind of feedback loop is that? That's a nice negative feedback loop. And what does that usually provide in the body? Nice homeostatic mechanism, right? That maintains blood glucose at the proper level. But this one only works if what? If blood glucose increases. What happens if blood glucose decreases? This operation right here is not going to control your blood glucose, right? This works only when blood glucose increases. So there has to be another mechanism that works when things change in the opposite direction. And so here is a great example of antagonism between two hormones, which is insulin, and the other one is glucagon. Probably when you've learned something about diabetes mellitus, you've heard about insulin, but maybe you haven't heard a thing about glucagon. But this is another hormone very important for the homeostasis of blood glucose concentration. So let's establish a state where blood glucose starts to decrease. And when does that happen? When you're fasting. Say you're fasting all night, when you're sleeping. Right, there's all the glucose in your digestive tract is absorbed. Blood glucose starts to decrease. But we said that there were receptors for glucose. Where are those located? In the pancreas, right? All right, and those cells then, when blood glucose starts to decrease, they stop secreting insulin. That's one thing, but probably even more importantly, they start to secrete glucagon when blood glucose goes down. Glucagon does one important thing. It goes to the liver. It's a hormone. So it's secreted. How does a hormone get from one organ to another organ? How does it get around your body? I gave you a slide on that. It gets absorbed by a capillary, gets transported by the blood, it leaves via another capillary where it can affect metabolism in another cell. If it has what? If it has a receptor, right, then it becomes a target tissue for that particular hormone. Okay, so then glucose goes into the blood, and it goes to the liver. And the liver has a store of glucose in it called glycogen. It's like a starch molecule. We're going to look at the structure of that in a little bit. All right, and glucagon changes the metabolism of that cell so that it chops glycogen down into little pieces, and those little pieces are glucose, and that glucose then goes into the blood. And when glucose goes into the blood as a result of the secretion, the glucose secretion from the liver, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes up. And how does that relate to the stimulus? Adds to or subtracts from? Subtracts from, right? So that's another nice negative feedback mechanism, right, which generally maintains homeostasis. It compensates for decreases in blood glucose. All right, so here we have two hormones, insulin and glucagon. Insulin, all right, decreases blood glucose, but glucagon increases blood glucose. They're opposite in effect. And because you have that antagonistic system, what is your body, if it's normal, okay, what does your body have? Homeostasis, precise control and balance. I'll have to talk about balance a little bit more later in the class, over blood glucose concentration, precise control and balance. And so that's an antagonistic system. If you only have one control mechanism over here, we call that a tonic control system. We go over that in lab. Those of you that haven't had lab yet, you haven't seen that. But that would be a tonic control. If it is bimodal, it's antagonistic, and that gives you the best control over your body. And we'll learn examples in terms of endocrinology and just relate it to the musculoskeletal system. As a matter of fact, you probably know a lot about antagonism already, because in the nervous system, there is a nervous system that automatically takes care of your body. What do we call that nervous system? What is that nervous system that automatically takes care of your body? Doesn't require any conscious thought. Autonomic nervous system. And how many divisions are there to the autonomic nervous system? There are two. And what's their relationship? They're antagonistic to each other, right, over all of those organs. And what are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? Glands, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle, right? Most of those are under antagonistic control. Okay. So that's it for the first chapter. Okay? Okay. Anybody have any other kinds of questions? That homeostasis thing is a little funny, right? It's what? Not maintaining something at a set level, but maintaining parameters that vary up and down within a range that's suitable to support life. So they're changing constantly, all the time, depending on your activities. All right. So that's good for that lecture. All right, so now we're going to start talking about chemistry. Okay. All right, so the things that we're going to talk about in this chapter, we're going to start, where's a good place to start if you got a topic that's kind of big and complicated? Break it down into small pieces, right? Understand the small pieces first and then add the small pieces together to get a good understanding of how the larger things work. All right, so we're going to start with the smallest pieces of matter that we're going to be interested in. We're not going to do nuclear physics. We're going to actually do chemistry. So that's atoms. Then we're going to talk about chemical bonds. That's how different atoms come together. We'll talk about some important molecules that regulate or change the pH of your body. So we need to define what pH is. And then we're going to talk about some organic molecules, and maybe I like the term biological molecule right here. We'll define what an organic molecule is and an inorganic molecule, but these right here, you should say, these are important biological molecules, okay? And there are four classes of them, and I'll show you how to distinguish them and why each of those are good. Okay, so let's start with atoms. These are the smallest units of chemical elements that we're going to be looking at. Okay, they're composed of some building blocks as well. And the three building blocks are protons and electrons and neutrons. So I want you to know something about these subatomic particles, where they're found in an atom, and realize that some of them have an electrical charge associated with them. So protons have a positive charge. Right. And protons are found in the nucleus. So the way that we're going to think about an atom is using a model of our solar system. So what's in the very center of our solar system? The sun. And what do you have in orbit around the sun? Planets. Okay, so use that model to think of an atom. And it's an okay model for some kinds of chemistry. Certainly the chemistry that we use in here, that works. All right, so in the center right here, which is the sun in our solar system, we call that the nucleus, right? So just like in anatomy, you might have a structure, it will have a number of different names, right? You can have a name referring to a number of different kinds of things. Like a nucleus, you know, is what? From anatomy, it's a center of gray matter in your brain someplace. It's a group of dendrites and cell bodies in your brain. That would be a nucleus, like the basal nuclei. Right, but don't confuse it with this part of an atom. Right, a nucleus is also an organelle inside of a cell that contains chromosomes, which is not anything having to do with this nucleus of an atom. Right, so just be aware of that. That an item can have different names depending. What's another good example of that? How about what's this street right out over here? Lincoln Boulevard. Thank you. I was thinking of the other name. I couldn't remember Lincoln. Okay, Lincoln. Lincoln becomes what as you go into Long Beach? Carson. Yeah, so it's the same street, it just changes names, right? So just be aware that sometimes you have to know multiple names for one item, and sometimes one item might have different meanings, or one name might have different meanings, okay? All right, so in the nucleus right here, there are two subatomic particles that can exist there. They are the protons and the neutrons. Protons have a positive charge, and a neutron has no charge on it whatsoever. The third particle that makes up an atom is called an electron. And an electron has the opposite charge to a proton, exactly opposite to it. And so that means it's going to be negative. Right? And we find electrons in orbitals right here. And also, you should also think of an orbital as a shell. So electrons go not in the nucleus, but shells or orbitals. Another thing probably you should be aware of is, and I'll just ask a question to get you thinking about that. If you have a proton and an electron, do they like to associate with each other? Do they like to ignore each other? Or are they actually attracted to each other? They're attracted. So in terms of electrical charges, opposite charges attract. All right, same charges like to repel each other. All right, so in passing, I'll just say we have a bunch of protons inside the nucleus right here, but since they're all the same charge, what are they doing? They are repelling each other, and that's the reason why neutrons have to end up inside the nucleus, so that all those things that like to get away from each other can find some kind of space where they're happy together. Okay, that's the whole purpose of neutrons. Somebody usually asks me that question. It's not important for our class, but that's why they're in there. All right. And these electrons then are in orbitals or shells. Okay. And we can draw out different shells. Here is the first shell or the first orbital right here. And this is a chemical called hydrogen, and it has one proton inside the nucleus. Right? And so, in order for this to be a neutral atom, it's got to have one electron. And it's in this first shell right here. All right, now, I do want you to know a number of elements. Not all of the elements that exist in nature, but at least the ones that are important in terms of biology. So I want you to know the name of them, but also the chemical symbol. All right, so the chemical symbol for hydrogen is H. That's really nice. Right? And the chemical symbol for carbon is C. That's really nice and simple. Okay? The chemical symbol for oxygen is O. Right? Now, some of you probably haven't taken chemistry, but you know the chemical formula for water. What's that? H2O. So that means there are two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen put together by chemical bonds. Okay? We're going to actually build a water molecule probably today. All right, this carbon right here, you see, has 6 protons in it, okay? And the hydrogen has 1, and that's really what determines the difference between different elements, just the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. That's the difference between gold and silver and lead and carbon and sulfur, is just the different number of protons that are inside the nucleus. And if you change the number of protons inside the nucleus, what are you changing? The element that it is. Right? That's very difficult to do. You need a nuclear reaction to do that. That doesn't happen in chemistry. All right. So I think I have a table here someplace that shows you. Good. I'm going to flip back. These are the ones you have to know for this class and the test. Right? So you got to know oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, what the chemical symbol is. And then this third column over here, the relative abundance, you don't have to memorize, but it's kind of interesting to look at. All right, so oxygen and the chemical symbol you have to be familiar with, be able to use that in language and use it in your any kind of calculations that we might do. Most of these things are very straightforward, like Mg stands for magnesium, right? Hydrogen and carbon, we already looked at oxygen. Some are not so straightforward unless you speak Greek, okay? So, for instance, potassium, you would say, what should be the letter for potassium? Should be P, right? Okay? And you see that it is not, all right? It's not P. Because potassium in Greek is called kalium. And you spell kalium with a K, all right? So hopefully some of you speak Greek in here. All right, same thing. There's a couple in here that are a little difficult. That's another one. How about sodium? You would think sodium should be S, but S is what? S is sulfur. Is sulfur on here someplace? Oh yeah, good, because there's some proteins that have sulfur in them, all right? But sodium is Na. Anybody know what Na really means? What does that stand for? Natrium. Natrium is the name of sodium in Greek. Okay. I'm not going to test you on that, but you will be tested by Na is sodium. Okay. Sulfur is S. What's another complicated one? Ah, look at iron. You'd think it's I, but it's not. Iron is? Yeah, Fe. All right, because that's the ferrous or, I don't know, ferrium or something, okay, in Greek. You don't have to know Greek in here. I is iodine. Iodine is very important in terms of your thyroid gland. So start memorizing these guys over the weekend if you don't know them already. Okay. All right, so atomic mass is just the sum of all of the neutrons and protons inside the nucleus. But there's something probably more important that I want you to know, and that is atomic number. Atomic number is just the number of protons inside the nucleus, and that's what determines what element it is. And that's going to determine its chemical properties, because if this is a neutral atom right here, if we have 6 protons in the nucleus, how many electrons are we going to have in orbitals? We're going to have the same number, and it's going to be a neutral atom right here. All right, so on the test, I'm going to ask you to use this periodic table. Actually, I'll give you a periodic table, okay, because I think this one right here, all right, it's got Na, but what else does it have right here, people in the first row? It's got sodium, all right, so that would be too easy on the test, right? So I'm going to give you a periodic table that has the atomic number right here, which is 1. It's got the chemical symbol, and you're going to have to know that stands for hydrogen, so I got to cover this periodic table up during the test. All right. So I might ask you, well, what's the atomic number for iron? So how do you figure that out? What's the chemical symbol for iron? Don't say I. It's Fe, which is here, and then right there is what? Yeah, 26. That's how many protons are inside the nucleus. All right. So you could figure that question out just like that. So that's the level that I want you to know the periodic table. It's a test that you know these symbols and that you know what that atomic number is, because that's going to determine the chemistry of your body. Okay, what those atoms are going to do for you. Okay. All right, let's talk about some of these shells right here. The shells determine the chemistry. This first shell is closest to the nucleus. And as atoms acquire electrons, it has to fill these shells up, with the innermost shells going to the outermost shells. And I have to give you some rules on how that happens. The first shell right here can accept 2 electrons and no more. That's it. So when 2 electrons get in there, it gets filled up. So if a 3rd electron is added to that atom, where does it have to go? To an outer shell, the second shell. So here we see the second shell, and so if 2 go onto this first one, how many do we need to add to carbon? 6. So here we have 2, that means how many go into this outer shell? There are 4, right? There's 4 in this outer shell. Now this outer shell right here, okay, how many electrons can go in that one? How many can go in that one? 8. All right, so there are 2 electrons in the first shell, the second shell 8, the third shell is 8. All right, so it's 2, 8, 8, 8, and that's as far as we're going to go in this class. Okay, so those are some rules. Okay, that's probably not so important. All right, so far what have we learned? How many main regions does an atom have? How many domains does an atom have? And what are the names? You've got the nucleus, and then you have orbitals or shells. Either of those terms work fine with me. Okay? And in that first region or first domain, what kind of particles can go into that first domain that we just talked about? Protons and neutrons in the nucleus. What subatomic particles go in orbitals? Electrons only. Okay? So far, so simple, right? If you haven't thought about it before, I'm sure it seems strange. Chemistry, in my opinion, is maybe the hardest part of this class. All right. So if you haven't had chemistry, just kind of plow through it, and you'll be ready for the rest of the class. Those of you that have a good background in chemistry, you're going to say, oh, this is so elementary, and you might not study a lot for that first test. All right, but don't keep that attitude for the second test because you probably don't have the same background. So if you're really hot in chemistry and do get 100% on this first test, don't study the same amount of time for the second one because you're not as familiar with it, right? You're going to have to ramp it up for the second test, okay? All right, so what was I talking about? That was important that I mentioned that at that time, though. Okay. Well, the outer shells, let me go back right here. These outer shells, these electrons in the outer shells, determine the chemistry that atoms can undergo with each other. Chemistry is the making and breaking of chemical bonds so that different atoms will associate together and with different strengths. And so those we call the valence electrons, those in the outermost shells. Okay. And here is just kind of a little afterthought about a slide. An isotope, you might be interested in an isotope. For instance, uranium has different isotopes. Some isotopes are radioactive and some aren't, right? But if you have an different atoms, but they're the same element, right? If they have the same element, what does that mean? They have the same number of protons inside the nucleus, which is what? Atomic number is number of protons inside the nucleus. But if they contain a different number of neutrons inside the nucleus, they have, okay, a different weight of the nucleus. And those are what we call isotopes. And some isotopes are stable and some are not. If they're not stable, it will kick out neutrons with very high energies, and then that produces radioactivity. All right, so let's talk about chemical bonds. What do we want to consider in terms of chemical bonds? What part of the atom and what particle are we going to be considering? Electrons, and where do we find electrons? Yeah, in orbitals or shells. All right, so molecules are when we take two atoms and put them together. All right, so it's going to be an interaction between valence electrons of atoms right here. All right, so the number of bonds determined by the number of electrons that are needed to complete the outermost shell. So what did we say the rules were? Let's see, I can make a really quick graphic. The first shell. Here we got the nucleus right here. Here's the first shell. What do we got here? Two. Here's the second shell. How many should we have in here? The maximum, eight. And then the outermost shell? Eight. Right? Okay. See what the next slide is right here. Okay, so let's talk about covalent bonds. We're going to talk maybe about four kinds of associations between atoms or molecules. Number one is covalent bond. And all of these different bonds have different strengths. And I'm not going to give you a number of what the strength is, but I want you to be able to rank them in terms of strong versus weak. And covalent is the strongest kind of bond. So if you want to build molecules with a lot of strength, what kind of bonds would you use to put them together? A covalent bond, right? Not a weak kind of bond. All right, so a covalent bond occurs when atoms share electrons. So here is a key term, sharing of electrons. And if you want to think valence electrons, that's fine. Okay. So here we have two atoms. And I see one proton inside the nucleus. And I see another one with one proton inside the nucleus. What the heck kind of molecule does that look like? You would use your periodic table and find the element that has one proton. Where's that at? Where should I go, right or left? Left, up or down? Up. Ah, right there. There's a one right there. What is that? Hydrogen. Okay. So let's draw hydrogen out here really quick. All right, so there's the proton. Here's that one electron. This is plus. This is minus. All right. This atom right here is a little bit unstable because not only can you put two electrons in this first orbital, it actually wants to have two electrons in this orbital. All right, so how's it going to do that? Well, it's going to find another hydrogen atom someplace. All right, and how many electrons does it have in its outermost orbital? It's got one as well. All right, and these electrons sometimes are over here, sometimes they're over here. When they're over here, this nucleus says, oh, this first orbital's filled up. I'm very happy. And when these electrons are shared over here, this nucleus is very happy. This is a relatively stable molecule. It's formed a covalent bond because these two nuclei are sharing these two electrons. So this is what we call a single covalent bond. All right, so the key term for covalent bonds is what? Sharing of electrons. And in particular, this one right here we call a nonpolar covalent bond because no matter when we look at these two electrons, they're going to be evenly distributed over these two atoms. They're not going to be more over here and less over here, or more over here and less over here. They're going to be evenly distributed in time. They're just going to float around wherever they want to at any particular time. All right, so what does polarity mean? Polarity. Okay, plus and minus, something opposite or something different. Okay, so if I look at this bottle right here, is this bottle polar from a structural standpoint? Well, look, it's got a cap, and does the top of the bottle look different than the bottom of the bottle? Yeah, absolutely. So it is polar, right? Depending on how you look at it, it looks different. As opposed to some kind of structure that's not polar, what would be something that's not polar? Like a baseball, basketball, right? No matter how you look at it, it looks like what? A basketball or a baseball. Okay. So polarity just means that there's something different about a couple different ends of a molecule or a membrane or whatever we're going to be talking about. And in this particular case, no matter how you look at this molecule, it looks the same, so we say it is nonpolar. Okay. So let's make another molecule right here. Let's build a water molecule. This would be a nice test question, but I don't have time to grade something like that. All right, but this is will give us a little practice. Water is H2O. All right, so let's start with oxygen. How many protons does oxygen have? How would you figure that out? What's the symbol for oxygen? O. Where's O? Where's O? Where's O? Ah, how many protons inside the nucleus? It says right there. It's got 8. All right, so I'm just going to put a big 8 right here. Oh, maybe I got to find it. There works really good. All right, so let's put some orbitals on this oxygen. All right, how many electrons go in this first orbital? 2, and it's filled up. No more can go in there. So we need a second orbital right here. How many electrons are left? We got 6. How many should go in here? 8. Okay, but we got 6. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All right, so we got these two places right here that can accept a an electron from someplace. So if you want to find one electron, where are you going to look? Okay, hydrogen is a perfect example. We'll bring one electron with it. So here's a hydrogen. It's got one proton. And in the first orbital, it's got one electron. And let's bring another hydrogen over here that's got one proton. And its orbital's got one electron. But now these two electrons are being shared. What kind of bond is that? That's a covalent bond. This hydrogen atom is sharing these two. So here's another covalent bond. And so we got what? H2 and an oxygen. Right? So if we have H2, this 2 just means 2 hydrogens, if you haven't looked at that before. And how many oxygens? Yeah, and if it's 1, we don't put a 1 there. All right, to make it simple. Okay, now, it just so happens that oxygen is highly electronegative. There's a high density of positive charges right here. So if there's a high density of positive charges, is it going to want to repel electrons or pull electrons in to itself? It's going to want to pull electrons in. So most of the time, these electrons are associated with the oxygen molecule. And these electrons are associated with the oxygen atom, right? So these hydrogen atoms over here don't have a lot of electrons. So even though if you count all of the protons inside the nuclei of this water molecule and count the number of electrons, they will exactly cancel out so that a water molecule has no overall charge on it. If you look at it from this direction right here, guess what? You're going to see a bunch of electrons. And it's going to look a little what? What's the charge on an electron? Negative. It's going to look negative, even though the molecule is neutral. What happens if you look at the water molecule from over here? How's it going to look? A little positive. The same thing for this direction right here. It's going to look a little positive. And what do we call something that has a difference on one end compared to the other end? Yeah, it's polar. Right? It's a polar molecule. And it's a very important polar molecule. It's going to determine a lot of chemistry and a lot of different behaviors inside our body. All right, so the other thing, let's build on this concept. What about electrical charges? Opposites attract or repel? They attract each other. So if we put another water molecule on the board, what's it going to do with the one that's already there? Okay, is an H going to line up with this over here, or is an oxygen molecule going to line up with this negative region right here? The H is going to want to, because what is this right here? A little bit of positive, a little bit of positive, and a little bit of negative. All right, so water molecules, right, because there's a little bit of a negative charge right here, water molecules do attract each other, but in a very specific way. So actually, when you think of water, even when it's a liquid, there's a high degree of structure because of this association between the different ends of a water molecule. So you can actually think of water as a liquid crystal. All right. This association right here is what we call a hydrogen bond. And a hydrogen bond is very weak. And in the hierarchy of how we're going to learn chemical bonds, it's the third strongest. So it's not very strong at all. So if you want to build something that has a lot of strength, you don't use hydrogen bonds. But if you want molecules to be joined together and then taken apart and then put back together and then taken apart at a moment's notice, this is a really good bond to use because it's easy to break and it's easy to put back together again. So for zipping and unzipping molecules, for instance, hydrogen bonds are perfect. All right, so that's what this slide right here shows us. All right, for this oxygen, we see this end is a little bit positive, this is a little bit negative, and that's what produces this polar. All right, so these covalent bonds between oxygen and hydrogen are what we call polar covalent bonds. And not only oxygen provides for polar covalent bonds, but there are some other elements that do as well. And that is nitrogen and phosphorus, and there's one more, sulfur does. All right, so that's the reason why I wanted to talk about this slide. So what kinds of atoms produce polar? Would be oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, phosphorus. Okay. Let me see what the next one is. All right. Well, just like these two oxygen, what I have on the board, just like these two water molecules like to associate with each other because of right, these opposite electrical charges attracting each other. Right? If there are molecules that have polar covalent bonds due to sulfur, like an SH bond or an NH bond or phosphorus right here, which produce little electrical charges on a molecule, you think that those molecules would like to associate with water. All right, so these are going to produce polar covalent bonds, which are going to produce these little electrical charges right here. Do you think they would be happy with water being next to them? What can you tell me about opposite charges? They will attract. So if these molecules right here are going to produce some little negative charge on the molecule, they will want to associate with water. Right? So compounds that have polar covalent bonds want to associate with water. Right? So these are producing what? Polar compounds? These are polar. Then there are a whole set of compounds that are nonpolar, and they just don't want to have anything to do with water. And you're familiar with these in your everyday experience. Okay, there are certain compounds that are polar and some that are not polar. A good example of a nonpolar compound, maybe you were making some toast this morning, okay, and you put some butter on your toast, and you turned around, it slipped out of your hand, and it fell right on your pants. And how does it always fall? Yeah, butter side down. So you got butter on your pants. Can you take water, which is a polar compound, and get that butter out of your clothes? They don't want to mix because lipids, like butter, are what we call nonpolar. They just won't mix together because they don't have the proper combinations of these electrical charges. Butter has no positive or negative charges on it, while water is what? Very, very polar. Okay. So we're going to use, I'll refer to that concept some more a little bit later on. All right, let's go to the second strongest kind of chemical bond, and that's an ionic bond. All right, and the key term for ionic bonds is to transfer an electron from one atom to another. All right, so for covalent, what was the key term? Sharing. For ionic bond, it is transfer. So let's see how that happens. All right, so maybe I'll just draw it on the board really quick. Let's use a couple compounds. Let's use, what do we want to use right here? Okay, I got 11 protons. What the heck has 11 protons inside the nucleus? How would you figure that out? You're going to have this beast right here on the test. You go to a periodic table, and you find something with 11 protons in it. Where's 11? What do we call Na? Yeah, that's sodium. So sodium, have you heard of sodium before? Yeah, like table salt, right? So sodium has 11 protons. So here is the nucleus of sodium with 11 protons in it. What about those electrons? The first shell, 2. Second shell, okay, we got 8. How many is that so far? That's 10. We got one extra. Can it go in the second shell? Nope, filled up, so that means it's got to go in this third shell over here, and here it is, one lonely electron. All right, so this sodium is really unhappy. It has its outer shell almost completely unfilled. It's got one electron. We can either add 7 electrons to it, all right, but actually what's better for sodium is just to get rid of this one electron, and then its outermost shell is going to be filled, and it's going to be very stable. So sodium wants to get rid of that electron. So it's got to find an atom that wants one electron from someplace. And that atom has, all right, 17 protons inside the nucleus. What's the atom that has 17 protons inside the nucleus? Okay, right here. What is Cl? Chlorine. All right, so we got chlorine. We got 17 right here. Build that up. So first orbital, 2. Second orbital, right, I'm a little sloppy, 8. So that's 10 altogether, right? So how many are left? 7. But how many should be in here for this to be stable? 8. What's it looking for? Oh, who's got one? Sodium. All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So what happens, this electron can jump over to here. All right, so here is the new electron, which has a minus charge. All right, and so now this chlorine has got 18 electrons but only 17 protons, so that means that it has a little extra charge on it. What's the extra charge on this atom right here going to be if it has one extra electron? It's going to be negative. And this atom has lost the electron. It's only got 10 electrons, so it's going to be a little bit of a positive charge. All right, so these two atoms, are they going to repel each other or attract? They're going to attract because they have an opposite charge. And so that's what we call an ionic bond ionic bond is relatively weak compared to a covalent bond. All right, so you could build a number of different molecules based on that theory to see if they're going to form covalent bonds or ionic bonds, for instance. Yeah. Okay, positive charges go in the nucleus. Negative charges go in orbitals. All right, and we can determine the element that has 17 protons in it by looking at the periodic table. So just look over for the atomic number, which is 17. That tells us it's chlorine. And chlorine in nature, okay, should be neutral. How would you neutralize 17 protons? By putting 17 electrons around it. But when we put electrons around an atom, we have to obey the rule of filling up these orbitals. First 2, then 8. Okay? So we got 2 plus 8, that's 10. That means we got 7 electrons left over that we put into this outer orbital right here. But in order for this outer orbital to be stable, it needs an additional electron. And it can get that from the sodium atom. Just following that same kind of reasoning. Sodium has 11 protons in it, which you can see on the periodic table. And how do those 11 electrons get put into orbitals? 2, 8, and then there's one left over. That one that's left over can be donated very easily to another atom, so it jumps over to chlorine right here, which is looking for one to fill the outer orbital. Right? And when that happens, we have 10 electrons over here and 11 protons, so that means it's got a positive charge. And since chlorine has accepted this extra electron, it's got one more electron. It's got 18 electrons instead of 17, so now it has a little bit extra negative charge. And since opposite charges attract, sodium and chloride do associate with each other under certain circumstances. All right, if you look at table salt in a salt shaker, what does it look like? A nice crystal, sodium and chloride are attracted to each other, it forms a really nice, pretty crystal. Right? But if we take that crystal and put it in water, guess what happens to it? Everybody, it dissolves away. Just by putting sodium chloride, the solid, into water, it can break that ionic bond. That ionic bond is so weak that it breaks. Okay? But now what's the real reason why sodium and chloride can dissolve in water? Because what does water have on it? The water molecule, if you look at the whole thing, is neutral, but if you look at one end, it's polar. So the oxygen molecule likes to associate with chloride molecules. Here's oxygen, right? Here's a water molecule. This end is going to be a little positive, this negative. So this hydrogen wants to associate with a chlorine. And this sodium over here, since it's positive, wants to associate with the other end of the water molecule. So these guys are really happy together. Both are what we call polar compounds. So some things dissolve in water if they're polar, and they won't if they're nonpolar. Okay, so furthermore, these things, you see, have that electrical charge on them, so we call them ions. Something that has an electrical charge is an ion. But you don't have to be just a plus one or a minus one. You could be plus two, for instance, like magnesium, right, or calcium, have two positive charges on them. Okay, and, you know, we could work out the details. I don't want to work that out on the board. But so these are these ions right here? Because they have a charge. They're ions. All right, different than these right here. And so there are rules that we use to talk about ions. I guess maybe I'll talk about that right now. Okay. All right, so there goes the sodium away. And let me try this marker. Ah, what am I drawing right here? Okay, there's a cat. So here's how you can remember. A cation has a positive charge on it. Okay? And an ion that has a negative, so this is a cation. So what about sodium? Is sodium a cation? Yeah, because it has a positive charge on it. An atom that has a negative charge on it is called an anion. I don't have a funny graphic for that, but you could show me ones that you work up. You guys could think of something probably. An anion has a negative charge. So what about this chlorine right here? That's an anion. Okay. But that doesn't describe the situation completely because some ions have multiple charges on it. Like magnesium, is that an anion or a cation? That's a cation. It's a bivalent, right? Because the valence has to do with what? The outer electrons right here. A bivalent cation. What about calcium? That's a bivalent cation as well. Okay, and if you have an anion with two charges, that would be a bivalent anion, okay, or a trivalent anion, like different forms of iron can flip between those couple different states. All right, so that's how we talk about ions. All right, and this is really important because we're very electrical beings, and you don't really realize that until you start to study a little bit of chemistry and physiology. We're extremely electrical in our bodies. I suppose you kind of know that because when we're interested in somebody's heart, what's the first thing that we do? We get an ECG from them, which is what? Measuring the electrical properties of their heart, and that's based on all of these different ions right here. Okay, so we're going to have to understand how that all happens in this class. Yeah? Yeah? Or the previous one, or this one. Because that's the only way that this particular sodium atom is going to be stable. You got all those protons inside the atom, and what do like charges like to do? They repel each other. Positive charges repel each other. So those protons would love to fly out of the nucleus, and it would destroy that atom. And there'd be radioactivity all over the place. So in order for sodium nucleus to become stable, there has to be neutrons inside there. So, all right, so these neutrons are just placed between these protons so they don't repel each other so much. Except for H1 will have neutrons inside the nucleus. Right. And there's a hydrogen atom that has two neutrons.
I thought they were the same number.
Protons determine the element, not the neutrons. No, not necessarily so. The more protons you stick inside the nucleus as you move up higher and higher here with the periodic table, right, like here's one that has 72, here's one that has 73 protons inside the nucleus. As there's more and more protons inside the nucleus, it needs more and more neutrons in there to make it stable. And it gets to a certain point to where that nucleus is almost never going to be stable and it's going to fly apart. So a lot of these elements down over here are radioactive because there's no way to make that nucleus stable, even if you add a lot of neutrons to it. That's not too important for this class. That's not to say that radioactivity is not important in medicine. It is because radioactivity or radioactive particles are high energy. They can go through people, right? And they can bounce into bone and bounce back, right? And so you can use that to make images of things inside your body without having to rip them open, like an x-ray, for instance, or other kinds of imaging techniques. Yeah? Okay, so a cation, all right, what's an ion? It's a molecule that has a charge, electrical charge on it, either a plus or minus, okay? And if it has a plus charge, it's a cation. If it has a minus charge, it's an anion. And then furthermore, depending on the number of charges, we have to specify what that is in terminology. So if it has two charges, it's a lot different behavior than if it just has one charge. So if it's one, I didn't start the simple case. If it's one, like sodium, all right, let's say sodium. I'm glad you asked. I didn't tell you what the simplest case was. Here's sodium. Is that an anion or a cation?
Cation.
Cation. It has one charge. How do we talk about an ion that has one charge? Ah, I'm sorry about that. That is a monovalent. Monovalent what? Cation. This would be a bivalent cation. Right? If it had three, it would be a trivalent. All right? So if there's just one, it's a monovalent ion. And it could be a cation or an anion. So that probably makes a whole lot more sense now that you know what the monovalent, just one. Yeah? Okay. Okay. So here is... Okay, here is what we talked about already. Here we have a bunch of water molecules. Here is a sodium. And this is, what kind of ion is sodium? Can you see that little thing right there? Kind of small. Yeah, it's a monovalent cation. Right, so that means that this is a polar compound, so water will want to associate with it, especially the oxygen part of the water molecule. It will form what we call hydration shells around ions. And it also means that sodium ion is very soluble in water. It will dissolve in water very, very easily. Same thing for this chloride. Since it's a monovalent anion, it likes to dissolve in water because the proton ends of the water molecule want to associate with it. Okay? And so that's why sodium and chloride will dissolve in water very, very easily. If a compound is polar, like sodium or chloride right here, and it dissolves in water, it means that it has a love for water. So we say it is hydrophilic, right? Hydrophilic. If it is a nonpolar compound that has no electrical charges on it, it will completely ignore water, right? And we call that a hydrophobic compound. So lipids are hydrophobic. They don't want to have anything to do with water. Sugars and salts that are polar will dissolve in water very, very easily, or other kinds of polar compounds, okay, because of the formation of those hydration spheres. Okay. All right, we talked about hydrogen bonds already, so here is not quite as fancy a picture as I drew on the board. But nonetheless, we see these dotted lines right here represent hydrogen bonds. So there's a high degree of structure, even in water, even in liquid water. So I could ask you, in your opinion, is water kind of a slippery substance, or is it sticky? Okay. And you're out driving around in all the rain and slipping around on the sidewalk, so your impression might be actually that it's kind of slippery. But I want to change your opinion on that. It's actually a very sticky kind of compound. And I'll bring in a couple things to demonstrate a little experiment with you on Tuesday. Okay. But if we have a body of water, like a little pond or lake, maybe one right outside, the water molecules are so sticky because of these hydrogen bonds that we see right here. There are even some animals that can actually walk right on the surface of water because they're not heavy enough to break those hydrogen bonds and push the water molecules apart and fall in. Okay? What kind of animals am I talking about? Like little insects, water spiders, yeah, maybe even some mosquitoes. Yeah, if you drop a mosquito on the water, it's just not even going to fly. It won't even get into the water. Okay, has anybody seen a water spider like walking right on the surface of water? Okay, because all of these hydrogen bonds right here produce a force that we call surface tension. Okay, maybe over the weekend you could do a little experiment at home. Take a couple plates or saucers or something that you have at home, make sure they're dry, put them together, and then lift the top one off. And it should be really easy to pop the top one off. Now put some water between them. Put them back together and try to pull the top one off. What's going to happen? The bottom one is going to go right along with it. All right. In order to separate them, you actually have to slide them apart. You won't be able to really pull them apart because water is acting like a glue because of that surface tension. Okay. So I can do that experiment on Tuesday if I remember to do that. All right. And in some parts of your body, that surface tension is utilized to glue parts of your body together, and other parts of your body it has to be defeated so that parts of your body don't get stuck together because they won't function properly. All right, so we'll talk about that later in the class. All right, but surface tension is due to those hydrogen bonds. All right, there's one last thing that I want to talk about before we go. And I think I have it in this chapter right here. If I don't have it in here, I do have it. Anybody recognize this? Raise your hand if you recognize this picture. Ah, where did you see this picture before? Ah, it's on blackboard. Yep, that's the first thing you see. Okay. All right, so here we have a sulfur atom and a sulfur atom. This line right here represents the sharing of two electrons. Ah, this is a nice little quiz for you. What do we call, what kind of bond shares electrons? A covalent bond. And what's the ranking of strength for that? That's a strong bond. So here we have a couple of, here's a protein, and there's a couple of amino acids. Amino acid is a building block in how you make a protein. And these amino acids have two different sulfur groups on them that can join together with this covalent bond. So this means that in this region right here, these two segments of the protein are joined together very tightly, and it's going to cause a bend in this protein molecule. All right, so we call that a disulfide bond. That's a strong bond, difficult to break, and it's difficult to form. And hair is made out of protein. And guess why some people have curly hair? Because they have some sulfur in different parts of their hair that join together that form curls. And people, you know, there's millions of different kinds of hair. There's like super straight hair, kind of straight hair, wavy hair, wavy kinky, curly kinky, right? There's millions of kinds. And it all depends on the nature of where these disulfide bridges are between the proteins that make up your hair. Okay? And if you get a permanent, what do they do when you get a permanent? They break that disulfide bridge, put your hair in the configuration that you want, and then they reform those disulfide bridges, and it changes the structure of your hair. Okay? Okay. So that gives you a little feeling for how important this chemistry is. Okay, in terms of the structure of your hair. When you change the structure of a protein in most parts of your body, guess what you change? You change the function. So that's eventually what we're going to get to, how the function changes. Okay, so here is a very strong bond. Here is an ionic bond. Not quite so strong, right? So it can be broken, but nonetheless, it helps determine the structure of this protein, which then determines what? The function of this protein, right? So ionic bonds determine the function of a protein. Here we see some hydrogen bonds, right, between these two groups right here. So this is a weak bond that determines the function of this protein a little bit. Maybe it can be broken. It changes then the function of this protein, right? And then the last kind of bond that we're going to talk about before we go is a van der Waals force. Here are two molecules that are nonpolar, right? And if they're nonpolar, they don't want to associate with anything that has a charge on it. Right, they only want to associate with other molecules that are nonpolar, basically fatty kinds of molecules. These are by far the weakest kinds of bonds. All right, so the last thing I want to do is rank the strength of chemical bonds. All right, and there are four. What's the strongest kind of chemical bond? Covalent, and you should know how to talk about it in one word. Sharing of, yeah, those valence electrons. What's the next strongest? Ionic. What's the key term for ionic bond? Transfer. Transfer of electrons from one atom to another. Okay, the next kind is hydrogen. All right, bonds. So these are all bonds right here. Hydrogen bonds. Okay, and that's neither sharing nor transfer. It's just because some molecules develop a little negativity or positivity on some little area of the molecule. So, but these have to do with polar compounds. All right, so these are due to polarity. And then the fourth kind, all right, what did we say the fourth kind was? I just hit it. Your book does kind of slights this a little bit, but it's kind of important. But van der Waal. Sounds very Dutch. Forces. Between what kind of compounds? They have to be nonpolar compounds. All right, those are extremely weak, but they can help stabilize molecules, and if a bunch of them change on a molecule, it will probably change the function of that particular molecule. And what do we want to study in this class? Function. That's right. But in order to understand function, what do you got to know? Something about structure, and so that's why we need to learn something about the structure of this chemistry stuff. Okay? Okay, so that's it for today, except the sign-in sheet is going around. Who's got the sign-in sheet? Nobody's got the sign-in sheet? Oh, I hope somebody's got the sign-in sheet. I promised you all a sign-in sheet. Okay, now class is canceled because of the weather.